chapter 8. The temple has been built. Solomon's palace has been built. Starting to think, it feels like it's been a while since we've been here. We were here last week, right? We did. That's why. Okay. Yep, we did. So, the palace is built, the temple's built, and now it's time for the dedication ceremony. It's time to begin the temple's functioning. And so that's what's happening here in 1 Kings chapter 8. Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel, before King Solomon in Jerusalem, to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. So he sends out this invitation into the whole nation. It's not for a general congregation of all the men of Israel. It's for the heads of each household. So you wouldn't have had everybody in the nation gathering here for this. Only the leaders of each tribe and household. But it still would have been a fairly large gathering of men to come to this dedication ceremony of the temple. So what they're doing is bringing the ark up. And I was trying to find my picture, but for some reason it's not on here. So I got to try to locate that topographical picture for you of Jerusalem, and so you can get an idea of where things are. But if you can remember and pull down that map that you've all got hanging inside your brain, all right? Remember those old ones that roll up. So we're going to pull that one down here, and we're going to take a look at that. So Jerusalem is on sort of a teardrop-shaped hill. There is on, I'm trying to get this oriented from your side, so this would be east, and that's west, okay? North, south, east, west. So over here to the east is the Mount of Olives. And then you have the Kidron Valley, and then you have this teardrop-shaped hill called Mount Zion. That is where David built his city, most of it. That's where he brought the ark to when he brought it up from Kiriath-Jearim, and then he had to stop at Obed-Edom's house for a little while. So it's been there for 20-some years, well, no, a little longer than that, probably 40 years. It's been sitting in Mount Zion, where David put it. And I say 40 years, we'll get to why that's 40 years here in just a few moments. But on this little teardrop-shaped hill that is Jerusalem, if you go up towards the northeast side, the hill sort of juts out a little bit, and that is where the temple was built, Mount Moriah. It's its own hill. There's a little bit of a dip as you come from Mount Zion, you come back up to Mount Moriah. So the temple is sitting on Mount Moriah, which is a little bit higher in elevation than Mount Zion. And Solomon built the temple and all of its precincts there. And so they are bringing the Ark of the Covenant from the place where David had it, which was a temporary tent-like dwelling, and they're going to put it in the temple. Of course, this is huge. This is a monumental celebration. This is a very, very important day, because we have said the temple was not just a place where God would be worshipped, but it was a place where the king would rule over his nation. The temple was built like a throne room for the very simple reason that Jehovah God is acknowledged as the rightful king over Israel, and Solomon or any of the kings that rule after him are acknowledged as vassal kings. They're not full kings. They don't have all the authority. They only have some. The delegated authority. Only God alone has all authority. And so they are bringing this ark up very symbolically to say we are enthroning God in his throne room, in his palace, in his temple, so that he can begin rulership, or he can really continue rulership of Israel. So they gather all of the heads of the people of Israel, because this is representing a national election. And this is representing an approval of the fact that we still want God to be our king. So we're coming up to join in this parade that's going to accompany the ark from Mount Zion up to Mount Moriah, where the temple's now at. So the leaders of the houses are there to symbolically represent that we approve of this, and we are all presenting ourselves as representatives of our families in submission to the king. That's the picture that's going on. Okay? All right. So verse 2, all the men of Israel assembled to King Solomon at the feast in the month of, you're going to love this, Ethanim. All right? Anytime you see the im on the end of a word in the Old Testament, that's significant, or it signifies a Hebrew plural word. So Elohim is the glorious one. It's a word for God, but it is in the plural. Ethanim means the Ethans. How about that? Yeah, that's right. There's more than one. Oh. The Ethanim is a word that means the bubbling of the brooks, or it's kind of symbolic of eternal flowing. Waters that are moving, waters that are flowing. And so this month is called the Ethanim. Probably it's the seventh month. We have that little note there. Probably because the seventh month falls in the late October to mid-November range most of the time, and is the time when the rainy season in Israel begins. They have a winter like we do. It doesn't get quite as cold. Doesn't snow much over there, although it does occasionally. But for the most part, the significance of their winter is that it's a rainy season. So you get a lot of moisture coming down on the land, and that's going to water the land in preparation for the spring planting. Because once spring hits, you're not going to have a whole lot of rain until late summer, and then you get what are called the latter rains. If you ever see in Scripture speaking about the early rains and the latter rains, it's talking about these two periods of the year, in the wintertime and in the late summer. So you get the early rains in the wintertime, and that's what's going to water the ground, make all the grasses and the flowers grow, but then everything's going to get very, very dry. So if you don't have your crops planted and have a good root system established before the early rains end, you're going to have troubles. They're just not going to take. And then when you're just before they are ready to mature, you get the latter rains, which then help the fruit mature and ripen up. But the Ethanim is the seventh month, so we're talking about late October, maybe early November. Interesting thing about the seventh month, two major events happen in the seventh month every year in Israel. Anybody know? Eldon, you've studied out the feasts of Israel. You may know this. Do you remember which one is in the seventh month? I'm putting them on the spot. Tim? Nope. The Day of Atonement was on the 10th day of the seventh month. Hugely important day. On the Day of Atonement, one day a year, the high priest was allowed to enter the Holy of Holies. After he had prepared the proper sacrifices, he went into the Holy of Holies and offered the blood of a goat for the sins of a nation. It was an annual renewal of the covenant, so that every year he brought that blood in and confessed before the presence of God with the ark there in front of him. He confessed the sins of the nation and offered sacrifice for forgiveness, so that God would accept his people for another year. So this would sort of be like us having to go back and re-ratify the Constitution and vote in a new president every year. All right, except it was a lot more serious than that. Because what happens if God rejects your sacrifice? What if he says, nope, that's not going to cover it this time? You guys have just been too rebellious. That's bad, because on what terms does Israel dwell in the land? Under the terms of the covenant. So if God rejects that sacrifice on the Day of Atonement, and your sins are no longer covered by that blood sacrifice, then you're out. You're kicked out. You're evicted from the land. This goes back to what Jesus was telling the Pharisees and the Sadducees we just looked at a little bit ago in the book of Matthew, when he's giving the parable of the tenant farmers. He says they didn't pay the rents, and so they were kicked out, and God's going to give or the farmer is going to give that land to somebody else that will pay the rent. That's the picture, is God is saying, you have violated the terms of the covenant, and you're out. You're out of the land. You can no longer dwell in the land under the terms of the covenant. Well, every year, the high priest would take that offering into the Holy of Holies, offer the blood, sprinkle it on the Ark of the Covenant, and that was to atone for the sins of the people so that they could continue to dwell in the land under God's covenant. Anybody remember what the lid was called on the Ark of the Covenant? Had the two angels on it with their wings stretched out. What was that lid called? The mercy seat. Why is it called the mercy seat? What's inside that ark? What's supposed to be inside that box? The law. The Ten Commandments. Yeah, copies of the books of Moses are in there. So the picture is that as long as that seat stays on there, you're covered. The law is not going to come out to judge you. The king doesn't have to bring the law out and read it as a condemnation against you. So we put the blood on there showing that, well, look, condemnation's already been executed against that goat. Substitutionary atonement. The goat died in our place. We know we violated the terms of the covenant. We know we deserve to die. But God, you're merciful. You've provided that a substitute can die in our place. So we kill the goat. We transfer our guilt to it. Cut its throat, collect its blood, take it in, sprinkle it on the mercy seat. Why? So that the judge sitting on that mercy seat can see there's been a payment of death. I don't have to bring the law out and judge the people. All right? So it's a mercy seat. Well, I think it's significant that they are consecrating the temple in the same month that the Day of Atonement happens. Eldon. We don't know. The last recording we have of the Ark of the Covenant is before the deportation to Babylon. Beyond that, we're not sure where it went. The Egyptian Coptic Church claims to have it. Not the Egyptian. South of them. Ethiopia. The Ethiopian Coptic Church claims to have the Ark of the Covenant in a in a tabernacle. Over there. They have a priest consecrated to take care of it year by year, and they've interviewed him. Nobody else is allowed inside to look at it, but they interview him, and he describes it, and it sure sounds like it's the Ark of the Covenant, but you don't know, right? So it disappeared from history, and I think for a very good reason, because it was no longer needed. Because when Israel was kicked out of the land in 586, Babylon came down, destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple. That was very symbolic as well, that God says, you're not worshiping me here anymore, and I'm kicking you out of the land. You're no longer dwelling in the land under my covenant. I'm not your king. You're not my people. Get out of here. Which prophet was it? It was Hosea. Named his children Lo-Ami, which means not my people. It was a signification to the people of Israel that God has rejected them because of their rejection of him. They refuse to abide by the terms of the covenant. And so then when Jesus comes along and sits down with his disciples at Passover, and he holds up the cup and says, this cup is the new covenant. Why do we need a new one? Because we completely failed under the old one. We cannot exist in a relationship with God under the old covenant. It's not possible. We fail every time. Don't worship other gods before me. Oh boy, we worship other gods all the time. Don't make any graven images. We're constantly making graven images in our hearts, in our hands, things we can see and touch and feel. We worship them all the time. Don't take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. How often do we do that? We speak his name flippantly. We speak it without the reverence that it deserves. Honor your father and mother. Anybody guilty of this one? Yeah. Don't murder. Well, I've never shot anybody or killed him. Well, then Jesus comes along and tells us, look, the real intent of that was whoever's angry with his brother, that's the same as committing murder. Same thing with adultery. If you look on a woman to lust after her, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness. We're guilty. And there's no way around it. We are blasphemous, idolatrous, parent disobeying, thieving, murdering, lying, stealing sinners. I know, I didn't get all 10 of them. So under the terms of the old covenant, we cannot relate to God in any way except to be judged by him. That's why it's so important when Jesus comes along, holds up that cup and says, This is the new covenant. Because we desperately needed a new covenant. How do we relate to God now? Through the death of Jesus Christ. He's our substitutionary sacrifice. His obedience gets transferred to us. Our sins got transferred to him. So now we can stand before God, rightly related, but only through faith in Jesus Christ. So, that was a little bit of a sidetrack, but there you go. So they've gathered together for this very symbolic day. They're bringing the ark up to enthrone God in his palace. All, verse 3, all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark. Back up, I forgot, month of Ethanim. That's where I got off track. So, they began, if you go back to chapter 6, verse 37, we look at when Solomon began to build the temple, okay? Get a little bit of timeline, a little bit of history here. Chapter 6, verse 37, in the fourth year, that's of the reign of Solomon, the foundation of the house was laid in the month of Ziv, which is the second month. So, seventh month is sometime October, November. Second month is April, May. Right? Right about now, actually. So it was began in the fourth year of Solomon's reign in the month of Ziv, which is the second month. It was finished, verse 38, in the 11th year in the month of Bul, which is the eighth month. So what month did they celebrate the consecration of the temple? The seventh. What month was it finished? Okay, so did they do the consecration of the temple the same year it was finished? Probably not. Otherwise, they were doing the consecration before the temple was finished, and that probably would not have been the way they did it. It's not. They didn't do that with the tabernacle. They probably didn't do it with the temple to have the consecration ceremony before the temple was actually finished. And we actually get a little bit more evidence for us in chapter 9, verse 1. So we jump all the way to chapter 9, verse 1. As soon as Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house, and all that Solomon desired to build, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time. So, here's the timeline events, and here's how this connects. Solomon begins building the temple the fourth year of his reign, the eighth month. He finishes it the 11th year of his reign. I'm sorry, back up. He begins building the temple fourth year of his reign, second month. He finishes the 11th year of his reign in the 8th month. So he's about 7.5 years building it. Then what did he do for the next 13 years? He built his palace. So we have 20 years of building going on. He consecrates the temple at some point, offers up the prayer that we're going to look at in the end of chapter 8. Verses 12 through the end of chapter 8 are the dedication prayer of the temple. Okay? It's long, but it's fantastic in its theology and in its supplication. So we're going to take a look at that. So he offers up his prayer of dedication, and then it says the Lord appeared to him after he finished building both the temple and his palace. So here's two scenarios we can pick from. He starts the temple, finishes it, and they consecrate it the following year, because they couldn't have done it the same year it was done. So he either builds the temple and then consecrates it 1 year later, and then 13 years after that, God appears to him and answers his prayer. Or he builds the temple, builds his palace, and then there's the consecration ceremony 13 years after the temple was complete. And then they consecrate it. Those are about the two options we have. Which one makes the most sense? Well, hard to say. Would God wait 13 years to answer Solomon's prayer, or would Solomon wait 13 years to make sure everything was finished? We're not sure. So those are your two options. You can pick from which one you like. Okay? Those fit the biblical data for us. Probably what I lean towards is that it took him 7.5 years to build the temple proper, and then they were making all of the furniture. and getting all those things ready while he was building his palace, so that his palace and the temple were fully furnished and ready to be used after about 20 years. So in that scenario, the temple proper is what takes about 7.5 years to build, the building itself. And then they are working for the next few years on all the furnishings. You remember the descriptions we read about the two bronze pillars and the bronze sea and all of the carts with the bronze bowls on them? I mean, that was a lot of work. We don't do that stuff with CNC machines back then. It takes a long time. And so I think probably he built the temple in 7.5 years, and then it took him another 13 years to get all of the equipment ready, so that the consecration for the temple is actually 20 years later after he begins. So that puts us 24 years into the reign of Solomon, actually almost 25. And so the Ark of the Covenant has been in Mount Zion, in David's little tabernacle that he built. It's been there for about 20 years of David's reign, plus 25 years of Solomon's reign. So it's been in Mount Zion for close to 50 years, 40, 45 years, before we get to this event. So we can go back to the beginning of chapter 8 now, and we'll pick up. That talks about the timing. All the men of Israel assembled to King Solomon at the feast in the month of Ethanim. Oh, that's right. What feast? We talked about the Day of Atonement, but he specifically mentions the feast. The Feast of Booths. Yep. Yeah, Feast of. Yeah, Kim says it's not the Feast of Booths, it's the Feast of Booths. The Feast of Booths. Eldon, you remember what the Feast of Booths was to commemorate? Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. Well, I did mean to put you on the spot. The Feast of Booths was a week-long feast in which the people of Israel were supposed to come out of their houses and live in temporary constructed shelters. It's also called the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Tents. So they were supposed to come out of their permanent homes and live in a tent or some sort of lean-to that they would construct out of branches. And it was to commemorate the fact that for 40 years they wandered in the wilderness because of their disobedience to God when they refused to go into the land. So here is the interesting significance between the temple being consecrated in that month and the two feasts that occur there. You have the Day of Atonement, when we are coming as a nation before God to offer a sacrifice and renew the covenant for 1 year. And that's significant that the temple is built during that same month. When we're taking God's ark up there and enthroning him, we're asking him again to be our king, just like we have done every year at the Day of Atonement. That's significant. But it's also significant that that they celebrate the Feast of Booths in close connection, remembering that, hey, disobedience to God leads to wandering. It leads to you being lost. It leads to you just tripping your way through the desert when you could have been dwelling in the promised land and dwelling permanently. And so now we're bringing the Ark of God to a permanent dwelling place, no longer a tent. So it's commemorating that this time of wandering is over and God has firmly planted his people in the land. Now, they're going to continue to celebrate the Feast of Booths every year, but that's a significant connection between the two feasts that happen and the consecration of the temple. So verse 3, all the elders... Verse 3, really? Wow, okay. All the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark. Remember when David first tried to move the ark? How'd that go for him? Yeah, a man died. Didn't go well because David didn't do it according to the law. But like we were sharing testimonies about our last week, hey, when there's failure, the only thing you can do is learn from it. And so David learned. He went back to the law. He learned how they were supposed to transport the ark. And the next time, 6 months later, they had the priests carrying it the way God prescribed. Solomon isn't going to make the same mistake as his dad. So as they are bringing the ark up from its temporary tent in Zion and moving it up the mountain to Mount Moriah, where the temple is at, they have the priests pick it up the way that they're supposed to. Now, there were two long poles holding the ark up so that the priests didn't actually have to touch the Ark of the Covenant. Okay, so they take up the ark. Verse 4, and they brought up the ark of the Lord, the tent of meeting, and all the holy vessels that were in the tent. Excuse me, the priests and the Levites brought them up. Now, there's a little distinction to be made here, because when you see the reference to the tent of meeting, what tent are they talking about? And you can show this almost all the time, that phrase, the tent of meeting, refers to the same thing. The tabernacle. Excuse me. You drink out of this morning, Dan? Don't drink after me, okay? I feel that little tickle in my throat coming on. All right. When I was a kid, my dad did a skit for Boy Scouts. And there was this jar of water sitting on a log, and one boy came out and he was brushing his teeth. And he spit into it, into the jar of water. And had another boy come out and he was brushing his teeth. And he sort of spit into it too. Yeah. Third boy came out, did the same thing. I think four or five boys come out brushing their teeth, and they all spit into this jar. And the last one comes out and he's brushing his teeth, and he picks up the jar, takes a big swig of it, swishes it around, spits it out, looks at the jar, and swallows the whole thing. I don't mind drinking after people too much, but that might be a little severe. All right. The phrase, the tent of meeting, always refers to the tabernacle that Moses built, which for many, many, many years has not been in Jerusalem. David brought the ark to Jerusalem. He didn't bring the whole tabernacle. That was residing at Gibeon, which the names are a little scrambled up here, so I'm going to try to shrink them just a little bit so you can see where it's at. Gibeon here is about 10 miles or so north northwest of Jerusalem. This was called the high place at Gibeon. This is where Solomon went after he was crowned king to offer sacrifices for the Lord's favor. That's where God appeared to him the first time, was when he was before the tent of meeting. So the Levites are not only bringing the ark up to the temple, they are bringing everything up to the temple. So they have dismantled the tabernacle from Gibeon. They've transported it to Jerusalem, and they're going to store everything in the temple. You remember all the storerooms that were on the outside of the temple proper? They're going to be storing the tabernacle there because it's no longer needed. God has given Israel a permanent place of worship. It's no longer a tent that's moving about. It's now stationary. Feast of Booths, remember, wandering about in tents? God himself is no longer wandering about in tents. He's settled. He's got a permanent throne. So they've brought everything up. Verse 5. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who had assembled before him were with him before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted or numbered. These would be not only consecration offerings, they would also be thanksgiving offerings, they would be peace offerings, they would be all sorts of them. Now, this also does not mean... at this point it probably does, but at some points it says that Solomon offered 120,000 sheep or thousands of oxen. That doesn't mean they were slaughtering them all that day. It means he's turning that number of sheep, at least, over to the temple because there were daily sacrifices that had to happen. One lamb in the morning, one in the evening. On the new moons there were seven of them. So they had a regular supply of sheep and lambs and oxen that were needed for these sacrifices. So... But when it's talking here, it probably does mean that they were slaughtering all these animals. And so many of them, you just really couldn't even count them. So they are paving the streets up to the throne room of God with blood. Why do you got to do that? Because we are sinners. We deserve death and judgment. And if it's not going to be us, if we're going to be saved, something has to die in our place. And so as they're sacrificing all these sheep on their way up to the temple, and when they get into the temple, they are sanctifying, consecrating that building for God's dwelling to be there, and they are atoning for their sins as a nation. Right? So they're preparing themselves, and they're preparing the temple for God to dwell there. Then the priests brought the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord to its place in the inner sanctuary of the house, in the most holy place, underneath the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread out their wings over the place of the Ark, so that the cherubim overshadowed the Ark and its poles. Just like in the heavenly throne room, we read in Isaiah chapter 6 that there are cherubim constantly flying around God's throne singing praises. In the temple, there were those two giant golden statues of cherubim with their wings spread out, one on each side of where the ark would be, so that when they bring the ark in and set it, it's under this covered protection of the cherubim. It's in a place where the cherubim are there to sing praises to God constantly. It's the whole temple was a picture of the heavenly throne room. Verse 8, the poles were so long that the ends of the poles were seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary. But they could not be seen from outside, and they are there to this day. That's an interesting statement, for one thing. They are there to this day. So we have said throughout our study of this that when was this book of Kings probably written? Probably after the exile. Because it counts history for us until 20-some years after Jerusalem is destroyed. But we have this statement that the poles of the ark are still there. Interesting conundrum, isn't it? How do you resolve? See, the Bible's just so full of contradictions. You can't even trust it, can you? How do you resolve something like that? The poles can't be there till this day if that's being recorded after the temple's destroyed. Unless they destroyed the whole temple and left the ark with its poles there, but that didn't happen. Probably what's happened here is that our final author was was compiling royal records, royal historical records, because they did keep very good records in ancient Israel. And so he's probably pulling together these sources and putting them together. And he has this statement that he left in there. It's inspired. It's there from the. It's there by the Holy Spirit's control. But it wouldn't hold until after the temple was destroyed, because the ark wouldn't have been there anymore. Verse 9, interesting little comment he gives us. There was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. That's also significant, because it tells us that the covenant is still intact. God is still abiding by his side of the covenant, and he considers Israel to still be faithful to the terms of the covenant, that he's not rejected them. And so the tablets are in there. What things were put in the Ark of the Covenant at different points? Timothy? Aaron's staff that budded. That proved that the priesthood would go to Aaron and not to the Kohathites or the Merarites. You're right. Aaron's staff was in there. Anything else? Eldon? The Ten Commandments were, yep, and we get this statement that they're still there. That's those two stone tablets. Yeah, pots full of manna. Isn't it interesting that there's no longer a need to prove that Aaron is the right lineage for the priesthood, and so that staff's not there. Nor is there any... Israel is settled in the land there. They don't need the manna anymore. Now, it was put there as a reminder for them. But it's not there either. So those things somewhere have passed off the scene. We're not told where. Maybe it's when the Philistines captured the ark about 200 years before what we're reading here. Maybe it's when Kiriath-Jearim, the ark resided there for a while. Maybe in the house of Obed-Edom. We don't know. Maybe before that. But at some point, those other relics were taken out, and the only thing left in there is the Ark, or is the stone tablets of the Ark, contrary to Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, because I think when they opened that in that movie, there was nothing but dust inside. Boy, you just can't trust movies anymore, can you? Yeah. So, nothing in there except the two stone tablets. And when the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. Why is that important? Why is it important to know that the glory of God filled the temple? He approves. He has accepted this place as a place where he will be worshipped and where he will rule Israel. And so that cloud of glory that the Israelites saw, when they were pinned up against the Red Sea and the army of Israel was behind them, the pillar of fire came down and protected them from the Egyptians. And that pillar of fire led them all throughout the wilderness while they were wandering. That pillar of fire descended upon the tabernacle when Moses would go in. That is very symbolic of the presence of God. We call it the Shekinah glory. We see it in the New Testament when Jesus goes up on the mountain with his disciples. And it says there was a cloud upon them and he was transfigured in form and shone like the sun. Because there is a cloud that veils the glory of God, so that we can approach him. Okay. And so that cloud descending upon the temple is significant because it shows that God has accepted this as a place where he will rule and a place where he will be worshipped. And so after consecrating the temple, everybody has to leave because God dwells in that place and we cannot dwell in the same place where the glory of God is being revealed like that. Not yet, anyway. But we can now that Christ has died for us. But this is the consecration of the temple. Solomon's going to offer up his prayer of consecration or dedication here in the rest of the chapter, but we'll cover that some other time. Any questions or comments about what we read tonight?